Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, I am Patrick Beja and this is the Phyllis Club, but it's not the regular news show panel that we have every month. It's a special episode entitled Islam for Dummies. Hello and welcome everyone to the Phileas Club special episode. This is the first ever special episode we do, and it's entitled Islam for Dummies. The aim and the point of this episode is to talk about things that you might know already, but things that some others might not, and basically ask the most stupid, silly, idiotic questions about Muslims in general and the Islam, Islamic religion, to hopefully learn a few things about this. I'm not being clear at all, but that's fine because I have two guests who are going to be absolutely crystal clear. And that's first of all, Turkey, that people might suspect that you're going to be on this show. How are you doing, Turkey?
I'm fine, and thanks for this great show, because I already know that all you Westerners are idiots and dummies, so I'm glad to help you out.
Way to start the show and making friends. Thank you. I wouldn't expect any less from you. And so we also have a great person representing the U.S., and more specifically, those crazy Mormons in Utah, and that's, of course, Scott Johnson. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm well, Patrick. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Scott, I know you don't have a lot of time, so I already managed to insult you and your faith once. So I'm going to leave it at that and just launch into the show itself with the first question, which I'm not sure anyone here except for Turkey, so either Scott or me, could answer, which is, where does Islam come from in the first place? Can you do us a quick summary of Islam's origin in 15 words or less? Turkey, go.
Basically, Islam was brought by Prophet Muhammad in the year, I'm not sure exactly, around 600 AD, and it came into the in Mecca, where the Arabs are, and it's based on the both religions of Judaism and Christianity, which is Islam is considered the completion of the word of God of those two religions, and the final prophet is Muhammad. So that's basically it.
So what you're saying is that Muslims were Jews who became Christians, who then became Muslims.
No, Muslims mostly, especially in the Arab world, they were pagans. They worshipped stones and stuff like that. They didn't actually, they weren't Christians.
Right, but I mean from the religion standpoint, Muhammad is the last prophet.
Yeah, from so religious point of view, Islam is a completion of God's religion, which starts with Judaism, moved on to Christianity, and the final message is Islam, which abolished the other two, and Islam is the completion of that faith.
So do you follow... Oh, sorry.
Sorry. I was just going to say, what is it where... I assume this is in scripture, but where is it that's stated, or why is it stated that Muhammad is the last prophet? No other prophets? Nobody gets to carry the torch from him on? How's that work?
It says that he's the last prophet. Basically, it said that because the judgment day is so close at that time, that it's as close in the history span of humans, doomsday is near, and there's no more need for any prophets, and Muhammad is the final prophet.
So, is it like in Christianity, the you know, Jesus Christ is supposed to come back, if I'm not mistaken, at some point, and is he going to announce the rapture? Is that, you know, he's going to make Judgment Day when he comes back, or is that a little bit later, Scott?
From me?
Yeah.
Well, the general Christianity point of view is that at some point, not known to any one man, as far as anyone knows, Christ is supposed to return a second time. And, as far as determining it, the rapture, I think that's more a Catholicism kind of thing.
Okay.
But so I don't exactly know what all that means. But yeah, that's the general point of view of most Protestant and traditional Christians and
so then
Mormons.
My question is, since Islam takes its root in Christianity, can Muhammad be seen as, you know, when Jesus died, it was said that he was going to come back. Is Muhammad some sort of Christic figure that is the continuation, really, of Christianity? Or is he more the prophet that came along and said, okay, that's, you know, we were a little bit mistaken, but this is what is going to happen now, and it's a shift in the religion?
Actually, Muhammad is more of a continuation in his views of Christ, because even Muslims do believe that Jesus is going to come from heaven down. He will fight with the good people against the bad and the devil and Antichrist. He'll fight Antichrist and he's going to win. And then there's going to be his great kingdom for a few years before his death. Because Muslims don't believe that Jesus is dead. They believe he was never crucified. He was actually raised to the heaven, where he's waiting for the day where he returns to earth.
So this is sort of important. You're saying that Muslims believe in Jesus Christ and his return.
They believe in Jesus Christ as a prophet of God, and they do believe he's raised in heaven and waiting for the day where he returns and unites all of the followers under his banner against the Antichrist and his followers.
Okay.
That is totally news to me. I had no idea. It's very interesting.
First lesson.
See, we're all learning something. Here we go.
A second question I would have is, who wrote the Quran? The holy book of the Islam religion.
Well, according to the Islamic faith, the Quran is actually the word of God. So it was God who recited it to the angel Gabriel, who is the messenger of God to the Prophet Muhammad, and Gabriel would recite it to Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad memorizes it, and then he recites it to his followers, and then his followers wrote it down at the same time that he was reciting it.
Okay, so it's not like the Bible that was written by the apostles, right? I'm always afraid I'm going to say something stupid, but if
well, basically the difference is the Bible has been written after the death of Christ,
right?
100 years later. So the Quran was written during the days of the Prophet. However, it was united in one version during the second Khalifa, the third Khalifa ruled the Islamic world.
Okay. And so then, who is Muhammad? You're saying he's the prophet, so he's not a son of God or anything like that. He's just a guy, a man who got a calling and became a prophet, but he's not divine himself, is he?
Yes, we do believe that he's just a human being, regular human, who was given the divine power or will of God to be his messenger to man. And the same thing we believe about all the former prophets in both Christianity and Judaism. We believe Moses was a prophet. Jesus was a prophet of God. They were all humans, and they were all the prophets of God.
Okay. I had a thought right here that might be a little bit blasphemous, but I want to ask the question because it might tell us something about Islam too. When you said he was a regular man who was given divine power, I was tempted to say, wow, like a superhero or something like that.
I wasn't supposed to say that. We do believe Jesus was given divine power.
Okay.
As a prophet. God, Muhammad was never given a divine power for his prophecy.
So just divine inspiration.
Yeah, just divine inspiration and the word of God.
Okay. So if I had said, which I did not, wow, like a superhero, would that be considered blasphemous and would I be in trouble for saying it?
Oh, well, it really comes down to who you're speaking. And Prophet Muhammad is a very sensitive subject to the Islamic world, as you know. So it really comes down to who you speak, and it really comes down on how you say it.
Okay. If I say it like right. this, like having fun and joking and not trying to be insulting.
Depends on who you're talking to.
Okay.
If you talk to a very religious person, you make it joking, it's really an insult because you're not supposed to joke about the Prophet.
I see.
So I got a question that from based on that. this idea of things being sacred to a certain person or people is not new to me. I understand it. And the sacredness of certain things is sort of like, you know, you wouldn't... you know, walk into a Christian church and, you know, make fun of the crucifixion. It would be, you know, people would be offended by that. My question is, when people, let's say, you know, this is the controversy about the Dutch cartoon where they depicted the Prophet Muhammad, and that's forbidden to create any sort of depictions of him. And this is something that's run through an episode of South Park. And, you know, you've just seen it come up and here and there in different places. And, it seems like there's this crazy range of people who are faithful, but sort of, you know, this sort of thing offends them, but they're sort of like, well, okay, I can't really control that guy, so I'm just going to, you know, I'll just continue in my faith. And then it ranges all the way up to the other extreme, which is, I can't believe they drew this cartoon. There is now a death threat out to that cartoonist. Which brings me to the greater question is that seems to say to me that there are lots and lots of versions of Islamic faith. They all have the same base, you know, system of beliefs, but because it's a sort of technically unorganized religion, or a religion where organization comes in small pockets, at least that's my impression, there is no central church, for example.
Yeah,
there's no pope, there's no, like in the Mormon faith, there's, you know, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles or the president of the church, that sort of thing. There doesn't seem to be any kind of central control. So in that way, am I right in seeing or assuming that that the range of offense can also do with the range of particular slants in the belief system?
Yeah, that's actually correct. And actually, in Islam, in the Sunni part of the Islamic faith, which is the majority of Muslims, it's forbidden to have a centralized religious authority. It's against Islamic law. Islam in general, at its basics, you're supposed to understand it and you're supposed to learn it by yourself. You can ask for advice from a religious person, but you're not supposed to follow them blindly because you have your own mind to think about it. And the way people react, for example, about the cartoons, like every single Muslim was offended, their reaction differed, and it's more not about the Prophet offensive. It's that they felt it was an attack against them as Muslims, as Arabs, as general. It's just the whole controversy about anti-terrorism and war against terrorists. So it's a very complicated thing, and you really find different people reacting different ways. However, the majority did get offended, majority did decide to do something about it. And what some people might not know, actually, is it's not only about the Prophet Muhammad. Muslims do get offended, and they consider it a sin to even draw or make fun of the Jesus or Moses or any of the other prophets. They're considered very holy people that you're not supposed to draw or imagine or anything, because they are on a level that they're not equal to us, and we shouldn't try to make them to our level.
So it's a question of respect, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it's a question of respect. It's just that we believe that nobody can reach their level, and that nobody can act like them, nobody can look like them, because they were God's prophets. It's out of respect for them, we're not allowed to draw them or make actors playing plays as them, and so on. And it's this for all the prophets, as I mentioned.
Now, in Washington, D.C., this brings up another interesting thing, and I didn't thought about this before, but in D.C., there's depictions of various world leaders from different time periods who were thought to be very influential and very crucial to the peace of certain people, or to the growth of a certain nation or whatever. And one of these statues that was erected many, I don't know how long ago, 100, 150 years ago or something, was there was a statue erected of Muhammad, and my understanding is that it still stands. It's in I think it's in the Supreme Court building or something. But anyway, there was a big controversy about having to take that down because it depicts the prophet. And my question is, in cases where they are doing something out of respect, this depiction of the prophet was created wholly out of sort of respect and memory of this great man slash prophet who walked the earth and was such an influence. Why would that, for example, be offensive?
I think the larger question is, as you're saying, Scott, this is not necessarily. It might be done to show respect, and to us, it's hard to imagine why something like that, just depicting someone, would be a sign of disrespect.
That's what I'm getting at. It's obviously it is, and obviously culturally there's a difference there. I'm not blind to that at all. Obviously there's something we're not seeing about that. But I'm just curious if it's every single case, like no matter what, if there's a depiction, is offense automatic? Or
it is for Muslims considered offensive, even if it's meant in a good way. And although the reaction would differ, however, in Islamic belief, you cannot depict the prophet because there's no picture of the prophet from the day when he was there. So trying to imagining him is an insult for him because there's nobody that can give him his just in building an image of him, a true image. So maybe if there were cameras, photography at the time, or his image was painted at the time, that wouldn't be as big of a problem as it is now. It's just about nobody can actually depict the prophet in a way that they can say, well, that's actually the prophet. And you can see that also about Christ, Jesus, and you can see it about Moses. You can see different pictures, and they're all always different because they were never real pictures about them. It's only people trying to imagine and build that image of those people.
So you're saying that the fact that we are inaccurate is actually an insult. If we can imagine that, I don't know, I'm going to think outside the box here, but let's suppose that someone gets a divine inspiration that tells him this is how Muhammad looked like, draw his picture, and this is who he is, and it was correct, then it wouldn't be that big a deal. But since we can't really know, the fact that we're doing it incorrectly is an offense.
Yeah, that's the basics of it. Okay. And also, we do come to the point where some religious beliefs in Islam, and most of them are the extreme or middle to the right, they don't accept drawings or statues. They're considered anti-Islamic.
Let's move along a little bit. And you're saying, of course, that some people think different things, and I think everyone will understand, but it's good to say it too. There are degrees in Islam, as there is in anything, not only religion, so we're not claiming that these answers are universal. But you did touch on something that I want a little bit of clarification? about and that's the Sunni and the Shiite. What exactly is the difference between the two sects? Can I say that they are sects or school of Islam?
Yeah. Well, basically, the Sunni they are anti-central religious authority. They follow the Holy Quran and the Sunnah, which is the sayings and the doings of the Prophet. And while the Shias are a broken out sect that happened in around 700 AD, I believe, or later in 600 AD, and they believe that the rule of the Islamic world should have continued within the descent of the Prophet family, basically his nephew, Ali. And they were basically Sunnis. However, throughout the years, they developed into a completely different sect where they have a religious authority, central religious authority. And they are divided into basically 13 different Shiite sects. sects, and they basically follow things that Sunnis don't believe. One, of course, is the central religious authority, and other belief systems like Ashura, the way they celebrate Ashura. They also respect and honor and visit the graves of religious and important people. It's against Sunni Islam to build a monument on a grave and to visit it and to pray for the person there.
Okay. How do you become a Muslim? Is it through blood, meaning if your parents are, then you are? Do you need to be, I'm sorry, but baptized a Muslim? stuff like
well,
that.
Well, yeah. Well, you do get born as a Muslim. If your parents are Muslim, you're automatically considered a Muslim.
So you don't need to be. You don't need to be sort of baptized, because in the Christian faith, if you're not, if you can be born out of a Christian family, if you're not baptized, then tough luck. You're finished. You're going to burn in hell.
No.
some Christian faiths.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's not everyone, but yeah, that's an interesting take. Usually, like for example, in Mormonism, you're called what's called a child of record until you're 8, and that just means you're sort of there. You're with your family or whatever. You get baptized and you're 8, and then you're technically on the records of the church. I assume there's something. I'm like Patrick here. I'm assuming there's something similar with Muslims, but it sounds like it's just a birthright. Or is there a way to join? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, there is a way to join, but if you're born from a Muslim family, you're automatically a Muslim. And unlike, I believe, I don't know whether this is an entire Christian belief or is it just Catholic belief, that they say that child is born with sin, as Muslims believe a child is born pure and clean. So it really comes to that. And you can convert to Islam.
I like that
anybody.
Version better, by the way.
That, you know what? It's funny. People, I'm just going to throw this out here, and we don't have to talk about it much. But people, there are a lot of parallels in very basic, some basic fundamental belief systems between Mormonism and Muslims. Specifically, if you're a Catholic and you're a baby and you die before you're baptized, Patrick's right. The belief there is, and so a Catholic, if I'm saying this wrong, a Catholic can correct me, but the understanding is that kid's lost. You're done. You're in whatever hell they've decided you're going to. In Mormonism, we believe children are innocent, and if a child dies before they're baptized or they even have a choice or whatever, that we believe that child is safe in the arms of Christ. It's not an issue of, oh my gosh, this innocent child died and now he's in hell, and just because we didn't get water to him quick enough. I'm not knocking Catholicism, but it's one clear difference. It's interesting that this seems like one of the similarities that I keep hearing about is between certain basic Muslim beliefs and certain basic Mormon beliefs, and some other Christians as well.
Yeah, let's be all inclusive. So
yeah, I don't want to exclude anybody, but yeah, and so I guess my question is, if let's say you were born into a Muslim family, but 3 hours after you were born. Let's say you were born on an airplane between Dubai and...
Wow, that's going to get complicated.
Dubai, you're flying from Jordan to Dubai, and the baby's born on the plane because you just went into labor and there was no chance, you couldn't land or whatever. And you're like, oh, phew, the baby's fine, everything's good. Whoops, someone opened the airlock and the baby flew out of the plane and landed safely in a jungle someplace. And gets raised by some indigenous people in the jungle and has no idea who his parents were or what happened. At the end of the day, is that kid still considered Muslim? I know it's a little stretch, but I'm just wondering: is there anything about upbringing or any of that makes him Muslim,
no,
or is it just?
It's all about upbringing. And there is a saying by the Prophet where it clearly says, and Sunnis believe in this saying, that a child is born pure at heart, believing in one and only God. However, his parents decide what faith he follows, whether he grows as a Jew, a Christian, or a Muslim.
Interesting.
So what steps do you have to take to actually become a Muslim after you're
born? If you're born, there's no steps. If you're raised as a Muslim, it's just something that you're automatically a Muslim.
Okay, so there's no clear path like, step one, get baptized, step two, get confirmation.
No,
you just
no.
have to learn about the Quran and the Muslim.
Yeah, just study normal Islamic laws and things like that.
How about someone that isn't born a Muslim? What do you need to do to become one?
there's only one thing, one basic thing to do to be a Muslim, is just to declare that there's no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his prophet. You declare that, you're automatically a Muslim. That's it.
And if you're born a Muslim and you think Buddhism is really cool and you'd rather be that?
This one is a complicated one. And it really comes down to who you talk to, who you ask. There's been a division. So I'm going to try to give you the different point of views. And when I'm saying this is my point of view, then keep in mind, most likely that means the minority point of view.
Okay.
If I say this is the general point of view, that's the most people believe. And then there's the point where people are divided on. So it's basically not, it depends on who you talk to. So it's kind of 50-50. When it comes to changing religions of Islam, it's kind of like I would say about 80%, 50 to 80% of people believe that you cannot switch from Islam to another faith. If you do so, it's death penalty for you. So that comes down to that. I believe, and I believe some people, a minority do believe, and this is what I believe from learning what I learned about Islam. Islam has always declared itself as a religion of choice. So giving an option, if you pass, you're 18 years old and you're considered officially an adult, then you could choose which faith, because nobody can force that faith on you. If you decide to leave it, then yes. The 50-50 division is some do believe what I'm saying. However, they also believe if you convert to Islam as an adult and then decide to go back, then you're officially considered for the death penalty. Hmm. So,
and the death penalty, because there's no like central control over anything. Does that death penalty just mean, hey, whoever's, you know, lives near that guy, run down the street?
No. There is a central control, but it's not a religious central control. It's the ruler. The ruler is the one who has the right to decide whatever he thinks is right. He cannot declare an Islamic law specific, but he does have the power to decide different things. And you're not allowed to do anything against his will.
And who is he, would that be like a father in a home? Would that be like someone who runs a mosque?
The ruler is the king, the president, whoever is ruling the area, the country.
Okay.
So it's really comes up to what we call Wali Amr al-Muslimin, or what roughly translates as the father of all the Muslims.
Okay, that's interesting, because what I'm falling into a typical American trap of what we're used to, which is law, like civic law and religious law, are two very separate things, and never the twain shall meet. But it's interesting to hear this point of view. Well, sometimes they try
well,
not.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Well, always, in Islam, okay. Islam is considered a governmental religion. So it's a religion that has laws, that, and especially like countries like in Saudi Arabia specifically. Saudi Arabia is based on Islamic law. There's no civil law here in Saudi Arabia. All Sharia law. If you go to other Muslim countries, they would have, the basis would be Islamic law, but they would have some civil law in it to accompany other things. But the basis would be the Sharia law, the Islamic law.
So we're saying that if someone stops being a Muslim, that he should suffer penalty of death. Is that like the theoretical thing that we read about in the Quran, or does it actually happen in some places?
No, this is never written in the Quran. As far as I know, and as far as I studied the Islam and grew as a Muslim, it's never written in the Quran. This concept of that if you believe Islam, then you're punished, is based on that when the Prophet died, Muhammad died, a group of Muslims, so followers of him in the central region of Arabia, decided not to convert back to their own religions, and they refused to pay the new ruler who took over after Muhammad, Abu Bakr, the alms, because Muslims are required. I'll talk about this later, but there are five pillars. And one of the pillars of Islam, which is you have to do if you're a Muslim, is pay alms, and which is a small amount of money. Whatever money you save throughout a year, you have to take 2.5% of it out and give it to the poor. So it's usually collected by the central government and then divided to the poor. However, these people refused to give those alms, and Abu Bakr declared that he would fight them, and they called them infidels who returned from Islam. And people are building on that. That's the reason he fought them, is because they left Islam, and they're building that on that, that the punishment for leaving Islam is death. However, historically, the reason he's fighting them is because they made a deal with the Prophet Muhammad, and they broke it about paying alms, and he's fighting them to protect that deal.
Interesting. So is a bit like the Christian concept of tithing.
Yeah, basically, since we're talking about this, Islam is based on five pillars. Like, these five things are required by every Muslim, and if you're a Muslim, you're supposed to follow these five things. If you don't do one of these things, you're considered someone who's punishable by Islam. And these things are basically there are five pillars. The first pillar is to declare that there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his prophet. You say that, you become a Muslim. Then you're required.
I'm sorry, just a second about this. Can I just say this in my room in my home alone, and that's it?
Yeah.
I'm a Muslim.
Yeah, that's okay. It. The second thing is required of you that you pray five times a day, and the third thing you're required of you is that you fast during the holy month of Ramadan, and the fourth thing is to give alms to the poor, which is the 2.5% of whatever money you save throughout a year. And the final thing is for whoever is able physically and financially to perform pilgrimage to Mecca Hajj once in his lifetime, at least.
We spoke about this before, and you told me that one of the parts of this that was very misunderstood was the part where they say, if possible for you, right?
Yeah, it's considered a big deal. Doing the pilgrimage for Muslims is considered a big deal, and some people actually suffer just to go through it. They either too old, too weak, and they still go through it, or they're too poor. They actually end up selling their homes just to go and do that, and come back with there's no home left for them, just so they can. And such people, officially by Islamic law, they're not supposed to do that, and they're kind of sinful at doing such a thing, because they should look after themselves first. And if they're able financially, physically, then they should go and do the pilgrimage.
So, if they live super far away, do the people that live close? Like, do the faraway people get ticked at the little close people? Like, for example, you're right there in town. So it's like an afternoon. And for everyone else, you know, they're out traveling across the desert and doing all this stuff. Is there any kind of division? It seems a little silly, but I'm just curious if there's like a cultural division.
Yeah, actually there is. And it's kind of has been a big problem here for the government in Saudi Arabia. They've been having problems with people here, and it's really bothering a lot of people. There are people, not only in Saudi Arabia, there are people who come from outside the Saudi country. For some reason, they're able to get their visas. But mostly Saudi people, some of them actually do pilgrimage every single year, which is really annoying. And it really bothers other people, either those who haven't performed their religious stuff, why is he able and we're not, or because they just put too much traffic on the pilgrimage. Because usually, on average, there's about 2.5 million people at the same moment and end up doing a pilgrimage. So it's really, until recent years, I think they started last year. Now, to perform pilgrimage, if you're within Saudi Arabia, now you have to get a permit first. And you're not allowed a permit except once every 5 years.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I was curious about that. Now, this brings back another point, though. And I may just be totally naive to how these two concepts work together. So I apologize if it comes off sounding stupid. But you mentioned that Islam is supposed to be it's a very personal religion. It's a religion that you study yourself. It is in fact laid out that there should not be a centralized controlling governance over the religion. However, it seems in conflict, and I don't want to talk about whether this is a good or a bad thing. I'm trying to reconcile it with myself, how all of that being true, yet there is central governance. There's like this leader of the town, province, or country that you mentioned, who has to make the choice of whether or not somebody should be killed because they left the religion, or they've got to have governance to say, well, you can only get a permit every 5 years, or you know, they have all of these ruling groups and general schools of thought that seem like centralized religion in a weird way to me. Am I totally off whack thinking that way?
Well, kind of, and not. For example, when you're talking about the whole permit every 5 years, it's not about religion. This is basically about helping people, more people, to do the pilgrimage. It's kind of control. It's organization. Like if you have the Super Bowl, if you have all of these people, if you allow everybody to go in at the same moment and leave at the same moment, it'll be a huge disaster. So this is an organizational thing. It's not really religious. When it comes right. for this part,
right?
For
but
example.
If you're, what I guess I'm saying is, if your brother decides he wants to leave the faith, and
yeah, well, that
why is that? Why is that not a personal like thing for him to decide, and not for someone else to decide his fate or whatever?
As I said, it really comes to the what thought you're looking at, the group of thought. And as I said, for me, I would consider you're supposed to be allowed. There are people who think that people should be allowed. There are religious facts that say no, he should be punished by death. And it's kind of and the good thing about this is actually it's a good thing that there is a higher authority that you can turn to. For example, in Saudi Arabia, there's no way the Saudi government would ever execute anybody for converting from Islam. The worst they would do is tell him, pack your bags and leave the country. So if there wasn't this strong authority, these religious groups would just take everything in their own hands and decide they are the law. And that's basically what terrorists are doing. They believe they're right. They just don't follow the leader of the country, and they do whatever they believe is correct, and they end up killing and torturing people.
Mm. I'm going to interrupt you for just a second, ask you one question, and then answer a couple of questions I got on Twitter, one of which having to do with terrorism. First of all, what happens if you don't do these five things, if you don't follow the five pillars of Islam?
It also comes down to the ruler. Basically, if you don't follow these five pillars, the majority thought is that you're not a complete person, a Muslim, and you're a sinner, and you should be advised. So usually people would approach you, you know, you should do this, you should do that, and so on. And it's kind of some of these, and most of these things are very difficult to follow. So people cannot do them and nobody would notice. You can pray at home. You can claim you're praying at home when you're not praying. So nobody can say you're not praying, and so on.
I guess my question was more, and the other question going with that is, if there's a hell in the Islam faith, if you don't do those five things, do you go to hell when you die?
That's what I think one of the things that makes Islam unique from Christianity. As far as I know, and as I say, I know more about Catholicism than other Christian faiths, so most of my knowledge there. And in Christianity, they would say you either go to hell or heaven. There's no middle way. However, in Islam, a person can actually go to hell even if he's a good Muslim, to be punished for whatever bad things he did, and then he can move on and go to heaven. So there is a hell and heaven, and it's not either or, it could be both.
So you still go on, it's not your life that's going to determine everything that happens after you die. You can still move on, I don't know, go to hell for 10,000 years and then move on to heaven because you've been, you know, cleansed.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Can I ask a question about the praying? Is it praying five times a day?
Yes, five times a day.
Is it specific times? Or, I mean, you know, for example, if I'm walking around in a mall in Dubai and I'm a Muslim, and do I hear like a bell at 4 o'clock and I just hit the dirt and go to town? Or is it predetermined time?
You will hear the adhan, which is the calling of prayer. We don't have bells. So there's a calling of prayer.
All right.
We are not Christians. We don't ring bells to call people to come to Mass. But you would hear a calling of prayer, and you're supposed to head to the mosque. And it's usually, there's a specific time when it's exactly the time the prayer time starts, and that's usually when people do prayers at the mosque. However, it's usually open. You have a period of time where you can do that prayer later alone or at home. So there's a period.
That's interesting. I always thought they just had to stop, drop, and wherever you were, whatever you were doing, it was prayer time.
No. There's a period. Like we have the noon prayer, which starts at exactly at noon and goes all the way until afternoon. It's about 3 hours long. And then we have the afternoon prayer. And then there we have the sunset prayer. And then we have the night prayer. And then we have the sunrise prayer.
And when you pray, do you just recite verses and that's it? Or do you also have to, I don't know, send good thoughts in the universe? Or
no, it's verses. It's a special way to pray. Special movements, read verses, special verses. However, you are allowed also within those verses, like if you're done with the verses, you can add whatever you want, whether it's a prayer to God or whatever you like to say, you can say and talk to God directly. So.
Can you ask for things for yourself? Can you pray for Nintendo Wii?
You can ask for anything. You can pray for God for anything you like.
Good. I was saying I just asked people on Twitter what their most common stereotype about Muslims and Islam was. And I got a few answers, so I would like to submit them to you and to get your reaction. Maybe we can do a few, so if you can... if you can answer them, address them as fast as you can so we can get through a few of them. So the first one was Fure. I'm not sure I'm reading this right, but she said, or he said, the picture is not very clear. I'm sorry if I'm offending you. he said, all Arabs are Muslim is one of the stereotypes. Is that true?
That's a mistake. Not all Arabs are Muslims, and not all Muslims are Arabs. Arabs are there are Christian Arabs. There are actually Jewish Arabs. So no, and that's not correct at all.
Okay, a couple of people said they are terrorists. I think he means it jokingly, but how do you? It ties into another question, which is. In general, do Muslims feel threatened by or think poorly of typical Westerners and specifically Americans? That's a question by Lancer X. So I would have to merge the two into one, which would be, you know, if we think that you guys are all terrorists, do you in return think poorly of all of us?
Well, basically, if all Muslims are terrorists, then all Christians are terrorists. After all, we do have the IRA, we have the militias in the U.S., we have a lot of Christian groups who are terrorists officially.
I would, at the risk of being inflammatory, I would say that there are more in numbers and more threateningly Islamist terrorists at the moment. I mean, you might consider that the Inquisition was the biggest terrorist group ever, maybe. But
I would consider the Crusades the biggest terrorist group ever.
Yeah, that's what I meant, the Inquisition.
The biggest problem with all of this, with this particular topic, is the label itself. Because you could easily say, I can't remember his name, but the guy that blew up the federal building in Oklahoma in 95. Yeah. You could call that guy. You could call that guy a jerk. You could call him a fundamentalist freak show. You could call him a white supremacist. You could call him an anti-government nut job, or you could call him a terrorist. And it seems to me that term is so, at least in the last 8 years or so, has been so freely, you know, slapped onto various things that it's a very dangerous thing for us in the Western world to do.
Well, actually, that is true. And for example, one of the biggest problems with the word terrorist, and people do hear and find offended, is, for example, calling Hamas a terrorist group. Now, I'm no fan of Hamas. I'm anti-Hamas. I think Hamas is doing everything wrong, and they are a danger to the Palestinian people. However, Hamas is not a terrorist group. They are freedom fighters, and they won free elections, and nobody treated them as a group that won free elections, and they were treated as terrorists. So that's the problem. The real problem with Muslims, with the Western world, is not individuals. It's not with you, Scott, not with you, Patrick. It's not with the person walking on the street. Muslims really have huge problems with the governments, the way the governments react to these, their countries and their people. For example, the U.S. government is one of the most hated governments in the world. And you can actually go on the street and talk to people, and many of them would actually tell you that there's a difference. They don't have something against U.S. people, citizens, but they do have a problem with the U.S. government, and so on.
Right. So they make that distinction.
Yes, they actually do.
But do you feel like that's a distinction made or a problem created in the last decade that, or maybe more, but do you feel like there's any shift in that thinking with our new president, with a general sense of, you know, we got to get out from underneath this oppressive sort of everyone's a terrorist and, you know, we're going to blow everything up to prove it and stuff. Do you feel like there's a change in the wind or no?
Well, yeah, most people in the Muslim world, at least that I know of, are waiting and to see. And as President Obama said, it's not my words, you just wait and see my deeds. So that's what our people are waiting. They're going to see what's going to happen, and they're hoping for the best. People are not really thinking things are going to change. They're just saying, well, let's wait and see. Maybe there's something going to happen. Who knows? But nobody's really excited and overjoyed.
But there's not a blanket, they're all asses, and we don't want to talk to them.
Well, there are. You would find.
Oh, sure. I mean, it depends on yeah. every person.
Yeah, but I would consider that a minority.
Okay. Another couple of questions from Twitter. Mashup Man asks, says that one of the stereotypes is walking in front of their women in public, and Hokito also says lack of women's rights, which, you know, can lead us to the topic of women in general, and, you know, the fact that Muslims have multiple wives, like Mormons, like I was saying. no, they don't. But yeah, yeah,
I know Scott has 10.
Yeah, I keep him in the basement. This was actually on my list too, because the whole women thing seems, you know, I'll tell you, there is a stereotype in Utah specifically that all women are to stay home and raise kids and keep having kids and not go to work. And
so you mean the stereotype actually exists?
Oh, that stereotype definitely exists. Whether as it being a true thing, no, it's not
right,
true.
Right. Okay.
But that's my point. So I come to this topic of women in the Middle East and in the Islamic faith. I come to it not naive, thinking that on the surface, oh look, they're all wearing black burqas and what a horrible thing and what a horrible suppression. I know it's more complicated than that. I would love to hear more about how that is set up or why it is the way it is or what it actually is, because my guess is most people's guesses would be wrong. It's such a culture shock to see that, you know, I can't imagine probably the complexity involved with why it is the way it is. And my thinking that all of them feel like horrible repressed women is probably not accurate. So what is the truth about?
Before you answer, Turkey, I just want to say for the record that even though I'm sure there's a lot of cultural and religious reasons for the way women are treated in some Islamic countries, I think that's a point where I have to say, as a woman's right advocate, that's not, you know, that's something that shouldn't be the way it is. And cultural relativism is not an excuse for that. But, you know, that's the woman in me speaking. Sorry, go ahead.
We call her Sheila. Go ahead.
That woman was really starting to worry me. So, the topic of women in Islam would need a whole episode itself. However, let's try to do it this way. First of all, what many people think that women are abused or women are oppressed and so on, please go and talk to those women. And I guarantee you, for example, and I was shocked myself, but this is true. In Saudi Arabia, like, I would estimate at least 60% of women in Saudi Arabia would refuse to take off their veil because they believe in it. They wear it willingly by themselves.
The assumption by some Western minds that they are doing that out of fear, you say, is not true.
I'm saying it's not entirely true. There are some that who do without the fear. However, the majority are supportive of this. And you would know that when you see them traveling overseas, because they're not even forced overseas when they're traveling, and you find a lot of women covering up from Saudi Arabia. So that comes down to a second point, that we have the whole veil thing. There are three different views about the veil. There's the view that says women have to cover up completely, including their face. Then we have the second view that women should just dress up and cover their body completely in anything decent and cover their hair. Their face is okay to be seen. And then there's the minority who believe the veil isn't even part of Islam, and that's a very small minority.
So the question is, though, even if that's true, though, I guess where Patrick is probably coming from and where most Western minds are coming from is we see this as, okay, well, that's cool. The ones that really believe in it and wear it, gotcha, awesome, good on you. You look great. Keep it up. Where I break down is when they say, if they decide they don't want to wear that stuff, then they're busted, yeah, right? They're trouble.
That and really depends on where you're talking to. In Saudi Arabia, yes, they would be busted and they're in trouble. In countries like Egypt, it's normal. You find a lot of women walk out around without veils. They're in Jordan and almost every other Arab country, an Islamic country, basically. The Saudi Arabia might be one of the only or one of the few exceptions in the Islamic world where it's considered law that you're supposed to cover up. And it really comes down to the fact that Saudi Arabia is based on Islam so much, and there's too much authority for religious leaders in this country. And in general, women do have a lot of rights, and considering the civil rights they have right now are in the Western world, it's great. But if we compare religious rights when it comes to religion, we'll find that Islam has one of the biggest rights for women compared to other religions as well. So
compared to Christianity?
Yeah, even compared to Christianity.
I mean, the state of Christianity today, I'm not saying.
I'm talking about the Christianity as it is.
Okay.
It's the origin of Christianity. Christianity evolved and added and removed, and it's kind of not the same Christianity like in 600 AD.
Sure.
So and Islam came at the time when women actually were treated poorly, and it actually saved and helped women at the time. For example, when the day Islam came into this in the Arab Peninsula, it was a tradition that if your wife has a child that it's a girl, it's an insult to you, and they would take that girl and bury her alive, the baby. And that's one thing that Islam abolished immediately, and so on. And one other thing, for example, women were not allowed to inherit anything. Islam abolished that and gave them some rights, not equal to men, but at least they do have rights to inherit. So there is rights in Islam. It depends on who you talk. Some would say it's perfect, some would say it's not perfect, and some would disagree completely on both points. And it really comes down to the person you're talking. There are rights, there are different views, and it's a very complicated. As I said, it would take a whole episode just to talk about this.
Just one thing that I wanted to say, I didn't want to interrupt, but when you were saying most women would want to wear the veil and things like that, first of all, you said 60%, which is probably a large number, but it still means that 40% wouldn't want to and they can't. And the other thing I want to say is that in every form of system of belief or society, you're going to find people who are happy with their condition. And I'm sure that you could have found slaves in the U.S. who were happy to be slaves, or maybe not happy, but who would have said, you know, I have a fine life and I'm good like this. I wouldn't want a different life.
Actually, slaves in this country abolished slaves in 76. And slaves, most of the slaves who were abolished refused to leave their owners.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my point. So it doesn't mean that. Okay, let's move on from the topic of women with one last question, though. What about those multiple wives? Do you all have 20 wives waiting to nag you at night when you come back from work?
It's like your favorite question.
You've been waiting all this time just to say it. Okay, first of all, Islam only permits 4 wives maximum. You're not allowed to have more than 4 wives as maximum.
Okay.
Second of all, the majority of people, Muslims, only have one wife. The majority have only one wife. Having more than one wife is the exception. It's not the norm.
They're just allowed to go 4 if they want.
Yeah, they are allowed to go more than one. And when it comes to my personal opinion, there is a rule in the Quran which makes it possible for you to have more than one. And personally, I believe this rule, nobody can follow that rule. So officially, in my point of view, Islam forbids marrying more than one. And that rule is, to marry a second or a third or a fourth, you are required by Islamic law to treat them all equally.
And you don't think it's possible?
I don't think anybody can treat women equally.
Yeah, I think it's hard one to woman treat is anyone.
I if think you have an one, apartment with five one woman guys is in. More than enough.
Yeah, but I mean, if the three of us lived in an apartment with maybe Randy Jordan, that's four of us. It's going to get to the point where we're not being treated equally, and not in a bad way, even necessarily. But it's not going to be equal. I guess I can kind of see your point.
Yeah. So that's it.
Interesting.
Another question that's not from Twitter. Is Islam? We were talking about terrorists and the fact that some fringe of the Islamic faith is sometimes more violent, but there's also thought of Islam itself as a maybe more violent religion than other religions. And I'm sure that there are ways to interpret each religion in a very violent way, but it sometimes feels like in Islam, infidels have to be killed or converted, and there's no other choice. And
That's a mistake.
Okay, so yeah, what's your
that's
take
not
on
true.
That?
And to prove that's not true, read the history books about Andalusia, read the history books about Iraq, Iran, and all of those countries. And if you actually read Jewish book, you would find that Jews believe the best time in their history in modern time was under Islamic rule. They had the most freedom, and they were treated equal. So it's to call Islam as a religion of fighting or hate or blood is completely not true. And if you really know the real Islam, you would know that it's actually a religion of love and good faith. And for example, by Islamic law, if you go to war, the soldiers are required by Islamic law, if they are approaching the enemy, one, not to destroy any trees, two, not to kill any women or children, three, anybody that goes inside their house and locks their door and not fight, they're not allowed to enter those homes and try to kill them.
So why do you think it is that the source of, the Islam is today a source of violence in many respects?
It's the interpretation. People,
like any other religion,
they just manipulate the words, interpret it in the way they like, and just go out on massacring people.
You don't think that the no centralized authority encourages the violent fringes, though? Because, you can say if you don't have a central authority to refer to, You might, follow that one crazy guy who says we have to kill everyone.
There's central authority in Christianity, and we still see the same thing happening there.
Maybe not today, but sure, it did. Very good point.
That's a very good point. If you look at the Crusades, that was obviously a very central authority, and talk about, a horrible time of violence against Muslims specifically. But I still come down to this thing where I have a good deal of respect for a religion where they're so central in their, I don't want to say dogma, it's not the word, but they're so central in what their doctrine is and how it's given to their people. Because if something goes bad, you can kind of point right to the organization and say, you guys have got a problem here. And if
you
things go
that,
good,
man,
you can point to them as well and say, wow, look how well you've led your people to do good things in this world or whatever. It seems like I then also have a lot of respect for the far other end where it's one guy who has his own personal belief system, who is not pressing it upon others, who does not judge others for what they choose to do, is only concerned about trying to do the best he can. And if somebody else offends him or whatever, he just quietly moves along and does his thing. It's the stuff in the middle where it's sort of kind of controlled by some groups, and there's different schools of thought, and one school of thought is very violent, and they skip over the stuff about peace and love, and then you got another half that is all big on the peace and love stuff, but they are hated by the guys who are more violent, and yet they all claim to be Muslims. It's or any religion, like any offshoot. The guy that, like I said earlier, the guy that blew up that federal building claimed to be a rock hard white American Christian, doing what needed to be done. And
so you either like the Catholic Church or the guys who hug trees in meadows.
Well, You know,
I doubt he's into the Catholic Church, considering the Inquisitions, the Crusades.
Yeah, but see, there's a case where you knew who to blame. But aside from all of that, and that doesn't, you know, just because you know who to blame doesn't take away the centuries of human suffering and all the other issues that come with that. But it just seems to me that all the world's issues comes down to people interpreting what they believe in any religion.
Well, the problem is you're
I just wish there was more of a secular take on things. I wish there was more of a general code of ethics. We do not judge each other. We do not hurt each other. We don't steal each other's stuff. And if we have beliefs about God or our origins or the universe or whatever, we kind of keep those to ourselves and within our families and only really have those things be prominent in our lives as they affect our ability to be good influences and to help people and to actually be a force of good in the world. And I'm not saying there aren't Muslims like that. Certainly there are. I'm not naive to that. In fact, I'm 100% sure that the majority of Muslim people have nothing but the best of intentions each and every day. It's just that sometimes it's always these extreme fringes, always. In the case of the Crusades, that might have been a different case because it was a very, you know, it's like Nazi Germany in a way.
The whole thing is based on media. It all comes down to media. And no matter what time and what period, it all comes to the media and the information people receive. And it really comes down to that. And as I said, I would never declare that Islam is a perfect, or that the Islamic governments or rural countries and rules throughout history have been perfect. I'm sure there have been abuses. I'm sure there have been trouble. But overall, the basics is it's been a very good history for Islam throughout time. And as I said, just you need to read books about. And the one example you just need to read about is Andalusia in Spain. And you can see Islam as it's supposed to be.
Hey, I have a question that might settle this for all of us here, which is maybe obvious, but for some reason we didn't think to ask it before. What do the Muslim people in general think of Al-Qaeda and, you know, the famous terrorist groups?
It really comes down to who you ask and what reactions they have about different things. Most Muslims, when it comes to terrorist attacks, especially like the terrorist attacks in Iraq where civilians are killed, either bombing a market or something, the majority are against that, and they believe that's completely wrong, and they're anti such acts. Many Muslims, especially in countries where there's low education, there's a low percentage of education in the population, like Pakistan. It's just so easy to manipulate such people, and they actually view Qaeda and people like that as heroes and saviors of Islam and fighting the devil. So it really comes down to the media, the education, and the people.
So for those people, there's a true belief that they are on the side of good, and they are fighting the devil.
Yes, and as I said, it comes down to education and media as a central force for this.
I guess we could talk about this for a long time. I just have a couple of questions again to go back to a more day-to-day, everyday life aspect of the Muslims' lives. There's a lot of talks, maybe it's just the Taliban, but the relationship between Islam and things like, you know, what you can and can't do, especially what you can't do, like listening to music, drinking, smoking. What can you not do that you, Turkey, know that we in the Western world do every day? What can you guys not do and why?
Well, there are basics in Islam that are clearly forbidden. For example, eating pork, that's completely forbidden in Islam. Drinking alcohol, that's absolutely forbidden in Islam.
You can never drink alcohol, ever?
No, you could never drink alcohol or eat pork, period. Those are central in Islam. That doesn't mean that all Muslims follow it, but those are central. And, like, those are clear
things that are bacon, forbidden. Dude, bacon.
No bacon, man. No bacon for us.
So you know what? That's interesting. You got, is it a health code? Is that why no pork, no drinking?
Yeah, it really depends on who you're talking to, and there's not an exact reason that's declared in Islam. However, there are writings from the days of the Prophet trying to explain why. And one of the reasons pork is considered a dirty animal and it's not healthy, stuff like that. There, alcohol is considered a dangerous thing that could make you unable to think straight, commit crimes and stuff like that. So there's different, but these are the clear, some of the two clear things. No gambling is allowed also. So these three are forbidden absolutely clearly in the Quran. Then you have the other things that are controversial things. Like in Taliban, they banned music, they banned TV. These are controversial. You find people who believe in that view that is forbidden. You have people who believe, no, it's okay. They banned, in Taliban, you were forced to grow a beard. It was required by Taliban law to grow a beard. If you're not growing a beard, you're punished. And then we also have, that's also a divided thing with Muslims. Some believe you have to grow a beard, others don't believe so. So
where
really,
you get the beard thing, is it, how's that? Where is that indicated for them to even take that and run with it?
And most of these controversial things, like the beard thing, they're controversial because they're not in the Quran. They're not clear. They are adopted from the Sunnah and the sayings and the doings of the Prophet. And during the days, everybody grew a beard in the days of the Prophet. There's some hadith that actually says you're supposed to grow a beard. So they're basing their thoughts on that.
Interesting.
Okay.
I don't want a beard.
Good to know. I think that's what we should take from this conversation.
Scott Johnson, I don't want a beard. Want a beard.
Yeah.
Hey, if you don't have a beard, you're not a real man.
Yeah. So you have a mustache, don't you, Turkey?
Yeah, I have a mustache.
Yeah, there you go. Real men have mustaches. Wow, that's going to take us in a weird direction.
Actually, in the Islamic and Arab world in general, it's considered a bad thing not to have a mustache.
One last question that I think is interesting.
Go ahead.
Technology.
Even two, if you want to.
Here we are talking on Skype, and that means computers, and that means technology and internet and electricity and all these things. I think there's a pretty broad base of people who have either the conception or misconception that if you're a good Muslim, you basically go Amish on everything and don't use electricity, TV. And you mentioned a little bit of that. But again, is that who you talk to and where you are and that kind of stuff?
No, that doesn't even exist in Islam.
Interesting. I wouldn't think so. Because
the extreme or the extra ultra religious people would have is TV, for example. And not because TV in general is bad, but because you can see bad things on it. So just get rid of it for good.
I see.
Stuff like that. Electricity is not bad. So you can have electricity for stuff like that. Really comes to if they believe this thing can actually bring bad, they usually throw it out.
When I was a teenager, my mom may have been an extremist because she wouldn't let me watch Three's Company and wanted the TV out of the house. So I'm starting to think there's a connection there somehow.
Come on, you want to watch gay guys staying with two girls?
Yeah, dude.
You're not supposed to watch stuff like that. Then you'll turn gay.
Three's Company makes you gay.
Yeah. That's what I heard.
What I heard, too. Okay, well, if you don't have any more questions, I know you have to go soon, Scott.
I do.
So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you, of course, Turkey, for giving us a small glimpse of what the Islam faith and the Muslim people are like. I hope you guys listening learned a thing or two during this hour together. This is probably the first of a few specials that I want to do. So the first one was obviously Islam. I think the next ones will be interesting also, but I will weave them into the regular monthly shows that we do about you know, general news. So as I was saying, thank you guys for coming on. Is there anything you want to pimp? Shows, TV, not TV, but internet things, your Twitter accounts?
Of course. If people don't know who I am or what I'm up to, you can follow me at just about everything I'm up to at myextralife.com. If you're into World of Warcraft, I do a show called The Instance that Patrick is also featured on. You can find that at theinstance.net. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/extralife.
Fantastic. Turkey, where can people find out more about you?
Well, you can try and follow me on Twitter, which is twitter.com/Saudi. And I try my best to write there.
Awesome. And so, of course, you can follow me at on Twitter at twitter.com/notpatrick. That's me. And the website is thephiliusclub.com. Of course, you can go there and comment. If you have any questions you want to ask about this show or any other, you can go there and comment on the article. Send me an email. All the information is there. We have a forum over there also. Lots of goodies for you to enjoy. And that's going to be it for this episode. I thank you.
And don't forget, yep. Anybody have any more questions, just send it to Patrick and I'll try to answer them for you.
You will? Or you're just joking so that I get flooded with email?
No, I'll try to answer them. They can flood you with email. I'm cool. Not giving my email. I want them to flood you.
Okay, I will. You know what? I'll transfer them to you and you'll let me know what the answers are and that I'll transmit that. So thank you very much for following the show. And we will talk to you on the next one, which will come at the end of the month. Thanks a lot and talk to you soon, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
See ya.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.